And welcome to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. We're going to discuss the top local news stories of the week with some of our region's leading journalists. Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean. And I just wanted to say it's great to be here on your last show. I know that you're leaving, moving on, and it's been a pleasure working with you over the years.
Oh, thank you very much, Jeff. It is my final show, but the show goes on, of course. Steve Junker of WCAI will be stepping into the host chair beginning next week, and I'm sure you'll be joining him as well.
Look forward to it.
This show, which we still have ahead of us, Sarah Brown's going to join us from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times. We'll talk with Josh Balling over on Nantucket, the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, and Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner on the tip of Cape Cod, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. So lots to talk about. Let's start with the ferry, the Steamship Authority ferry, which was a week or so ago now, ended up on the rocks at the Hyannis Port jetty.
It did, and it was actually 2 weeks ago tonight that happened, June 16th. And we continue to learn more this week about the crash. Still don't know the details of exactly what happened, but as we said, we did learn more. Last Friday, the Steamship Authority did announce that both the captain and the pilot did test negative on their drug test, but nonetheless, they do remain on paid administrative leave. And also, they were tested for alcohol within 2 hours after the accident. We did learn that. Then Tuesday, some more interesting information came out. Wayne Lampson, the general manager of the authority, addressed the steamship board on Nantucket and said that the captain mistook a metal pole and two moored sailboats as buoys when he was going into Hyannis Harbor. So they were in the exact same pattern of buoys 4, 5, and 6 that marked the entrance of the harbor.
So he thought that these poles were the buoys to go into the harbor rather than just sailboats that took them into the breakwater.
That's right, because they did shine a spotlight looking for the marker. They couldn't see it, so they did rely on the radar, according to Lampson, who also said there are 8-foot waves that shielded the breakwater from the radar and sight. But no, they were 800 feet north of where they should have been. And apparently all the navigational and mechanical systems were functioning, Lampson said. So they were quite a bit off course there. We also did speak with some former ferry captains. Ethan Genter has been following the story, doing a great job, in Sunday's paper. Spoke with a former steamship captain who said, "This just doesn't add up." Question what was going on there. He said that boat can go through some nasty weather. In fact, he referred to it as a race boat. Looks like a race car. Sorry. And his thought is perhaps either the captain or the pilot was distracted, and the other may have been inexperienced with the high-speed ferry.
How about the wave heights? I thought initially when that story broke, the information that came out was that they were closer to 4 feet. Now they're saying 8 feet.
He's saying 8 feet. That's right. What we had from the National Weather Service and also looking at the National Data Center shows that there are 4 feet waves on the Sound that night. And Tuesday at the Steamship Board, it was mentioned that there were 8 feet.
And the breakwater, that's not a small breakwater. What is that?
Like 3,000 feet. It's large.
It's large.
Yeah, it is. It's a long breakwater. And the ferry captain that Ethan spoke to said if he ever saw that green light to the right of him when he was coming into Hyannis Harbor, and this was an experienced ferry captain, his quote was, "I would freak out."
Oh, gee. I can remember that breakwater. Ted Kennedy was often seen. He would identify boats having trouble with the breakwater all the time, and he would go out there himself to rest. There are numerous stories of Ted Kennedy rescuing people from that breakwater. So, no, the National Transportation Safety Board is not investigating. It's Coast Guard doing this?
They are. The Coast Guard is doing the investigation. The NTSB did decline to be involved in this.
Do we know when the boat will be able to return to service?
Best guess the steamship has is July 21st, but there are some changes in the schedule. There are no high-speed Steamship Authority boats in Nantucket today. Of course, being the Friday of a long weekend, that's got to be a hit. As well as on July 4th, there'll be no service on the high-speed ferry. So Steamship Authority, this is going to affect them for the next few weeks.
And we also learned a little bit more about the rescue and some of the thinking that went into that. Initially, they were thinking, well, we'll let them stay on the boat until we have light in the morning. Because, it was dark, and obviously there was some nasty weather.
That's right. And those rocks were slippery. And they decided, we need to get this done at night. And that's why they took the chance, and they did take some folks off by helicopter or took some off by boat, those that couldn't navigate the slippery rocks at night.
A couple seriously injured,
15 in total. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, it was quite an incident, quite a story.
It was.
And I'm sure there'll be more information coming out as hopefully as they finish up that investigation. Mm-hmm. I know they've become a little tight-lipped about it now.
They have.
Let's talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Some pretty disturbing incidents that have safety incidents that resulted in discipline of plant workers. Mm-hmm. And this was over April, March.
Yeah, it was in late March and early April, Sean. Three more incidents, safety incidents, were reported to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Fairly serious. It resulted in disciplinary action against the employees. One involved safety systems from the control that control the release of radioactive material. If there had been an accident, obviously very serious. One was the heat testing a wrong switch, which caused a high pressure coolant system to shut down. And others involved operators in control room shutting valves, which led to a flood in the base of the reactor. So these are all very serious. The owners, Entergy, and as well as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, have reported that the employees involved in these were disqualified. They can't go into much detail given its personnel issues, but disqualified could mean anything along the lines of administrative leave to right up to termination. And just to make matters a little worse with incidents and disciplinary action, another report was filed last Friday where the reactor at full power, this happened, both doors that access the containment room were left open, and that should never happen because that is where that prevents radioactive material from seeping out.
That was really disturbing because it just seems like such basic
it
stuff.
Does.
You open one door, you close it, you walk through this containment room, you open the other door, go out, and you close it. Both doors were left open, which I think, as it said in the report, should never happen. And this reminds me of that memo that was sent last year when the NRC sent investigators, and a private memo that got into the hands of the Cape Cod Times said, the culture here of safety is a concern.
Very much so, very much so. And to thinking of that, and as you said, reading what happened last Friday, that, you know, it almost makes sense, even someone who hasn't worked there, to close the door. I
mean, to read about these is really disturbing. Of course, the plant will be shutting down. That's still the plan as far as we know.
Mid-2019.
Let's go to the phone. Sarah Brown is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette newsroom. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. So the Gazette was looking into what's happening on the island, and of course this is an issue statewide, when undocumented immigrants cannot get driver's licenses.
Yeah, and that's definitely it's a big issue here, but as you said, a lot of places. And it turns out, so undocumented residents are prohibited by law, basically, from attaining a driver's license in Massachusetts. You're required to have a social security number, other documents to get a driver's license. But at the same time, as a lot of us know, especially here on the island, driving is pretty essential for things like getting to work or getting kids to school or going to the doctor, any number of things. So a lot of people, undocumented residents here on the island, do end up driving without licenses. And here on the Vineyard, too, there's a pretty sizable number of undocumented residents, you know, mainly from Brazil. Mm-hmm. There aren't exact numbers, but estimates are about, I think, 2,000 to 4,000 or more from Brazil, and about half are undocumented. So that's a lot of people that, you know, like I said, do need to drive but can't get a driver's license. And this plays out in court here where there's a pretty high number of people who come through with unlicensed driving charges. But it's also, you know, with the new presidential administration focusing more on deportation and immigration issues, there's just more anxiety generally among undocumented residents, and this driver's license issue kind of comes up with that. And it's also an issue for local police, you know, and many of them, when we talk to them about this, that, you know, they're not interested in enforcing federal immigration laws, but they do enforce, you know, driving laws, and this is a concern, they said, for public safety, too, looking at it from the point of view that people who maybe haven't been licensed, gone through, you know, the testing and training that comes along with that, are driving.
Right.
So that's one facet. And one solution for some people has been to attain driver's licenses from states that don't require the same level of documentation that Massachusetts does. That's not a great long-term solution in the sense that state residents are required to get a Massachusetts license eventually. But there's also talk maybe about Massachusetts looking into changing their approach to licenses that would allow undocumented people to have a driver's license. That's in the mix. We talked to State Representative Dylan Fernandez, who said that that's something that he might be open to looking at and that the state might be open to looking at.
I know it's been discussed at the State House before without success, but
exactly, perhaps
in this different atmosphere, there'll be a different outcome.
Exactly. It seems to be a renewed attention on it. So, and we talked to a few island chiefs of police we talked to said they would be in favor of that. So that might be something that comes up again. And like you said, we'll see how successful it is.
Okay, Sarah Brown of the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, or the Vineyard Gazette, excuse me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean. It's been great talking to you.
It's been nice talking to you as well.
Thanks. Bye.
Goodbye. We're going to take a quick break. Tim Wood's going to join us when we get back. Tim's with the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll be talking about sharks. May not be real sharks, but we'll be talking about them. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Local News Roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. With me in the Woods Hole studio, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times.
Hello.
And Jeff, let's start with another story. This one, several big stories this week. This is about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, mm-hmm. who, of course, have been trying to get a casino in the town of Taunton, as well as get acreage of land in Mashpee, traditional land for the tribe in Mashpee, into federal trust. And it's just, every time they think they have a victory and are on the cusp of actually getting the casino built and getting their land into trust, there's a setback.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, Sean. You know, I started following this about 6 years ago and covered it for about 4 years, the Mashpee Tribe. Lots of twists and turns and ups and downs. This was definitely a down week for the tribe. On Tuesday, the Department of Interior was supposed to rule whether the tribe qualified for reservation land, its land in trust. I was supposed to make the announcement, and then the tribe unexpectedly and surprisingly announced that it was suspending its request for federal review, saying we're not going to go that route. We're going to resume our court battle with opponents to the casino in Taunton.
Makes you think they might have gotten a head up.
It does. And, right. You know, the opponents in Taunton said that they actually came out with a statement saying that they knew that the DOI notified the tribe that it didn't qualify, so therefore they decided not to. And this is a quote, accept the inevitable. How they knew that, we don't know.
Sure, of course.
But they did say that. So now it seems as if everything remains on hold as far as the construction in Taunton. The 170 acres in East Taunton, that's 151 in East Taunton, 170 in Mashpee, do remain in trust pending this appeal. So in the meantime, the tribe says it is going to be working with the Department of Interior to see if they qualify under a different category. So, yeah, it seems like we're right back where we were.
Well, what we don't know really much about is the tribe's finances. We do hear from some tribal members occasionally, but we do know there have been investors, foreign investors, that have helped the tribe get to this point, providing money for everything from attorneys to land itself, perhaps. We're not quite clear, but there's got to be investors who want to see this happen that the tribe's owed money to.
Oh, certainly. It's Genting, which is a gaming concern out of Malaysia, who have invested quite a bit of money over the years to try to make this happen and have the casino built in Taunton. So that is a big question that a lot of people are wondering about, Sean.
Okay. Let's go to the phone. Tim Wood is joining us. Tim, of course, is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle based in Chatham. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. So Chatham has really embraced the white shark phenomenon, and there's a park, I understand, in Chatham where there's all these kind of cutouts. What are they, wooden cutouts of great white sharks?
They're sort of a synthetic material, but yeah, they're basically 5-foot cutouts of great white sharks, and artists decorate them. Each one is sponsored by a local business or organization. And this exhibit is called Sharks in the Park, and it's put on by the Merchants Association here in town. Now, it's also turned out to be a pretty attractive nuisance in a way. Each year, this is about the fourth or fifth year, a couple of the sharks have disappeared. Usually they're recovered, but so far this year, there was an incident about 2 or 3 weeks ago where A few young women were caught on surveillance video in the park taking one of the sharks, but when they saw that they were being recorded, they put it back. Now, unfortunately, this past weekend, early Sunday morning, somebody was also caught on video taking one of the sharks, but they did not return it. Fortunately, a police officer on patrol discovered it, sort of cast off on the side of the road a few miles down Main Street. It was slightly damaged, but the artist who painted it was able to repair it. And actually, the sharks have moved from the park, which is also the as you know, on Friday nights in Chatham, the Chatham band puts on a great show in Cakewell Park. They have to move the sharks out of the park at that time because the Chatham band shows attract so many people. Mm-hmm. So they bring them down to the front lawn of the Eldridge Library, and they did that this past Wednesday. And they also brought with them the video monitoring equipment, which keeps an eye on the sharks 24 hours a day. That hopefully will be continue to be somewhat of a deterrent. It really hasn't. There's been, as I said, a few incidents, but police are currently looking at the security tape, and they are trying to identify the suspect from this past weekend's incident. And the merchants say that if they can identify the person, they're going to press charges because they really want to keep people from taking these sharks, because it's an enjoyable exhibit. Anytime you go downtown, there are people milling around looking at them. They're whimsical. They're fun. And they also include some educational information about the great white shark. So it serves a couple of purposes. And hopefully, if they can prevent further incidents like this, the exhibit will continue in future years.
Okay. Alcohol may have been a factor there, I understand, but
well,
it's just a guess.
It didn't help that the park is located near one of the more popular taverns in town. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, just briefly. So, I mean, we can talk about this next story on and on and on. But the shifting sands of Chatham again have people concerned about whether people are going to be able to get through the North Inlet there. What's happening?
Well, last weekend in the North Inlet, a narrow spit that juts out north of the tip of North Beach Island was cut through, and a little channel created there. It sort of stranded that sandy tip of the island, a few hundred feet long sandbar, which the coastal geologists who are watching Chatham Harbor very closely say that sandbar is going to eventually disappear, and basically this is a evolution of the Barrier Beach system, and this is a widening of that North Inlet, the one that was created in 2007. Now, what they think this is going to do is set the stage for that inlet to become the dominant one in the system. Right now, the dominant inlet is the one created in 1987 across from the lighthouse, but that's been deteriorating over the years as the 2007 inlet gets deeper and bigger, and it absorbs more of the flow of water in and out of Pleasant Bay and Chatham Harbor. A couple things about that: if the 2007 inlet does become dominant, it's going to make it easier and quicker for the fishing fleet, which is based on Aunt Lydia's Cove, to get out to the open Atlantic, and it'll basically probably close up that 1987 inlet, and will certainly make it more difficult to navigate if people can still get through there. It's an evolving system. You know, we saw in April a breach in South Beach that is causing some concern and also some assistance to people trying to get from Nantucket Sound to the ocean this summer. It's just constantly changing, as you said, Sean, and we sort of have to keep a very close eye on it as our boaters and as our the scientists who are interested in coastal geology.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. Good luck on your new foray into Boston.
I appreciate that too, Tim. Thanks.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Yep. Let's go. Of course, Jeff Splane is here from the Cape Cod Times. But Jeff, if you stand by, I want to go to Jim DeRuta, who's joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times newsroom. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Sean.
I understand, Jim, that there's a new CEO of the New Bedford Whaling Museum. Of course, the museum is really an anchor to the city of New Bedford.
Not quite a new CEO yet, but the current CEO, who's been there 9 years, James Russell, is leaving. Mm. And he's accomplished quite a bit there. And I don't know if you know it, but he's going to the Nantucket Historical Association.
Oh, great.
Will be running that whole complex, which includes a whaling museum there.
Sure.
Starting September 5th.
Oh, that's Nantucket's gain, New Bedford's loss, I guess. Huh?
I think that's going to be seen that way around in the whole industry, yeah.
And he's accomplished a lot in his time in New Bedford?
Quite a bit. I mean, they just completed a whole education building that vastly increased the footprint of the facility, and it brought in resources for research. It consolidated a huge whaling library that had been a couple blocks up the street in a rented space. And it's put the whole campus has become it's sent out its feelers into the whole city, and it's been a very vitalizing aspect to that part of the downtown, which is, you know, right practically the center of the historic district. He's been able to bring nearly 100, you know, increase visitors to almost 100,000 this year is what they're on, aiming toward. You must remember when the Charles W. Morgan, the last wooden whale ship, which was built in New Bedford, returned here about 3 years ago from Mystic. And
yes, of course.
James spearheaded that in cooperation with the folks at Mystic, who, you know, he sees as colleagues along with the Nantucket spot. He's been able to really increase volunteerism, built the endowment, balanced the budget. He's had a fantastic influence, and will leave the museum in very strong position.
Okay.
So I think you're right. He'll be missed, and I'm sure that they'll work quite hard to replace him with a capable successor.
Sure.
But Nantucket's going to benefit.
James Russell, President and CEO of the New Bedford Whaling Museum, moving on to Nantucket. Jim DeRuta bringing us the story from the New Bedford Standard-Times. Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. Best.
Best to you as well. And Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times, the paper of record. Do they still call it the paper of record?
I do.
You do. Now, did you think right. of it as the paper of record when you were at the Mashpee Enterprise?
Well, the daily paper of record.
The daily paper of
yes.
record. Okay, I was
yes.
just curious. Falmouth wind turbines. The town owns a few land-based wind turbines here in Falmouth. Mm-hmm. They've been causing trouble since they began to spin. And so it's been in the courts, really interesting case with the selectmen battling its own zoning board about what are we going to do with these turbines. And now we have more coming from a judge in that case.
We do. And, Sean, as you said, this has been going on for a long time, actually about 7 years since they started spinning. And last week, a judge ruled that to shut down the two turbines that are at the wastewater treatment plant in Falmouth. But now the Board of Selectmen has to decide, what do we do now? Do we appeal this, fight it through an appeal or not? And the issue that they need to deal with right now is the potential financial consequences of having these two turbines shut down.
So they took out some loans in order to get these things up and going.
They did, and they met for 2.5 hours behind closed doors this week and didn't come out with an answer as to what they were going to do. Once again, they said, we need to take a look at what some of the financial consequences are, but they have $5 million that they may need to pay back to the state. They need to find out if the state's going to want that back for the construction of the turbines. And also, that's only for one of them. The other one, Wind One, they call it, they have a $400,000 loan that they have to pay on every year. So there are some issues here that could have an adverse effect on the town if they're forced to pay all these back with the turbines not running.
And that financial issue has been hanging over the town for years.
Mm-hmm.
That has driven a lot of the debate.
Yeah.
Of course, there's some people have skepticism about what neighbors say they feel there or
right.
don't feel. But of course, I like to remind folks that many of the neighbors who live next to them who say they're affected by their spinning supported their erection there, they wanted them there.
That's right, a town meeting. In fact, we spoke with our reporter, Christine Legere, spoke with someone who said, gee, when we approved this, and she's a neighbor and said, I did, at town meeting years ago, we didn't think they were going to be this large and have an effect on the neighborhood the way they did.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, another perennial story that will keep going forward. Let's go to the phone. Josh Balling is joining us. Joshua from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning. So we were just talking about the ferry, and which had gone up on the rocks in Hyannisport, and so we talked a little about the schedule. Anything, any updates, Josh? Do you know about replacements this weekend?
I do know a little bit about replacements this week. The Steamship Authority was able to secure what they believe is enough capacity to handle the big crowds that will be coming to Nantucket, really starting yesterday, but definitely picking up today for the 4th of July holiday week, since it falls basically in the middle of the week. There had been some concern that there might be some people left without the trips they wanted to take without the INO on the schedule, but the Steamship Authority has contracted with the Sea Street Company to provide a 150-capacity ferry today. The High Line has also pulled its inter-island boat off the run between Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard and will be providing service between Nantucket and Hyannis today. And then starting tomorrow, the Steamship Authority has contracted with Sea Streak for its 500-passenger Wall Street Fast Ferry, which operates usually down in New York City, to take over for the INO. So the capacity is going to be actually a little bit higher this year than it was last year between the Steamship Authority and the High Line, because last year, if some people remember, the High Line's new fast boat wasn't online yet, so they were kind of cobbling together their schedule last year. So it looks like it won't be an issue for people who want to get to Nantucket for the 4th of July week on the fast ferries if they have reservations.
Busy weekend on the island, of course. Law enforcement getting ready as well, I understand?
They are. This is the second year that they have had a coordinated plan in place to really address what in the previous 4 or 5 years had been ever-growing beach parties on the island's south shore that had led to numerous arrests, numerous complaints from islanders and from town officials about the rowdy behavior down on the south shore, trespassing, beach vandalism, some other issue, public intoxication. And it's Board of Selectmen instructed the police to take care of it last year. They put a plan in place where they had checkpoints at most of the major access points to the beach. They did a very very thorough job checking for underage drinking. They prevented people from carrying too much alcohol onto the beach. And they're going to do the same thing this year. They've narrowed it down a little bit. They're going to be focusing on the two major beaches that attract the most people, Nobodyr and 40th Pole, one on the island's south shore, one on the island's north shore. But they will be out in force to keep the parties contained, keep them civil, and allow everybody on the island to enjoy really what's one of the busiest weeks, if not days and a couple days of the year.
And Josh, I was just talking with Jim DeRuiter from the New Bedford Standard Times. He was talking about James Russell, the president and CEO of the New Bedford Whaling Museum, coming to Nantucket, and I believe you've been writing about that as well.
We have, yes. Centuries ago, Nantucket whalers ended up going to New Bedford when Nantucket whaling wasn't able to happen because the harbor silted over. But now the director of the New Bedford Whaling Museum coming to Nantucket to take over for Bill Trampas, who has retired. They actually were friends, and Trampas suggested he might be interested in the job. And Nantucketers and the Nantucket Historical Association in particular are very happy to have Mr. Russell coming on board. He won't start until the fall, but there is an interim director in place. And from everything we've been hearing, he brings a wealth of experience to the Nantucket Whaling Museum, and it's nice to see the job stay in the region, if not in on the island.
Okay, Josh, let's leave it there. Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. And let's go right to the phone again. I appreciate you standing by, Jeff Spillane, but Ed Miller is joining us from the Provincetown Banner Newsroom. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Sean.
You have a little quirky story this week, which tends to happen out of Provincetown. It might be a bit of a trend I've noticed over the years. Now, this one is about some aliens.
Yes, well, you know, we are the Outer Cape. And this week we have a story that harks back to the film Men in Black 2, which came out in the year 2002. And for listeners who may not have seen the film or might not remember it, early in the film, there's a scene that takes place supposedly in the Truro post office where Will Smith comes to get Tommy Lee Jones, who is the postmaster in Truro, back into the service of this top-secret government organization that monitors extraterrestrials on Earth. And in this scene, all the workers at the Truro post office are revealed to be aliens. So
you looked into it.
Yes, our correspondent Rachel O'Brien went to the Truro and North Truro post office to find out a little bit more about this. And employee Melissa Shearer at the Truro post office when asked if fans of the film ever come in, she said, yes, sometimes they just ask if I'm an alien. And at the North Truro Post Office, Deb Perry said, it's not the same place. It's fictitious.
she cleared it up. Okay.
Other employees at both locations declined to comment. But it turns out that the two guys who wrote that film do have some history on their side. There are a few famous historical stories about aliens in Truro, particularly Carolyn Miller, who runs a psychic reading studio called The Third Eye in Provincetown and writes the horoscope column for The Banner. Says that she's encountered aliens more than once, first time in the mid-70s in her bedroom and in other places. There was another famous case, a man named Bob Matthews, who was an airman first class stationed at the old North Truro Air Force Station, who was supposedly abducted by aliens in front of the old Dutra's Market in North Truro, now the Salty Market. People still come into that store and say that, ask about it. And one customer apparently thinks that the whole store should be alien abduction themed.
Wow. Well, I can remember one of my first assignments up in Berlin, New Hampshire, was writing a story about someone who had seen an alien. And I don't think your career is complete until you've interviewed someone who's seen an alien, Ed.
Well, apparently not. And Carolyn Miller had some really interesting things to say about it. She realizes that making contact with aliens is not easy for most folks. She says, I think the people who have the experience, they're picked for a reason, but I'm not sure what the reason is.
Okay. Well, Ed Miller, the Provincetown Banner. Thank you very much, Ed. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. If I can just add a personal note, we're really going to miss you. And Ann Wood and I want to thank you for everything you've done for local journalism on Cape Cod.
Thanks, Ed. I appreciate that very much.
Take care.
You too. We're going to take a quick break. Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times, and we'll speak with George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times as well. Stick with us. And welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. With me is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, we spoke earlier about an intergovernmental lawsuit in Falmouth. Mm-hmm. Same thing happening between the county of Barnstable and the town of Barnstable. I believe this is your coverage area. They've been fighting and they've now settled a lawsuit.
Yes. I've been covering this since the beginning. This battle has been going on for 22 months. I did manage to settle it just under the two-year mark, which is fast with some of the stories we cover. But what has happened here is Barnstable did sue Barnstable County because of pollution and contamination of the Hyannis water supply. That was caused by perfluorinated chemicals, which are called chemicals of emerging concern. By the DEP, the EPA, that came into the Hyannis water supply as a result of firefighting foams that were used at the County Fire Training Academy, which is very close to where the well field is that serves Hyannis. So the result of the settlement was over $2.95 million the county will pay the town over the course of 20 years. But the way that it's going to be paid back is pretty interesting. The county, of course, has been having some financial issues. Really doesn't have – if it has a bond rating, it's not a good bond rating, and something I'm looking at as well. But the town is actually taking out the bond, and the county is going to pay it back with interest. So it's going to come out to about $3.6 million, and that bond's coming from the Massachusetts Clean Water Trust.
And going to create some clean water infrastructure there?
Yeah, exactly. And the county is also allowing the town to have access to the county farm, which is off 6A in Barnstable, to determine whether or not there is water there that possibly could lead to new wells serving Hyannisport and in the area. And also the county has agreed to pay the town $125,000 per year for maintenance of the carbon treatment systems they had to buy, as well as two filter changes for those systems twice a year, which $35,000 for each filter to change in one of those carbon treatment filters. So county's on the hook for about $400,000 a year for 20 years.
Wow.
So
let's talk about another story. So officials have been finding dead herons, these very impressive birds. This is in the town of Mashpee, primarily on tribal land. There's a herring run there, and that's kind of the area, right?
It is. It's off Route 130. This was a real mystery, very scary one as well. The ninth dead heron was found on Monday, pretty much in the same place where the others have been found. As we said, this is a herring run off Route 130. It's on tribal land. No explained cause. Some initial tests at the University of Connecticut veterinary labs were inconclusive. The state of Massachusetts is planning some more tests as well. General thought here amongst tribe members and some environmentalists in town is it may be from the herring that the heron are eating, and that may be indeed killing them. So therefore, they're telling tribe members who can actually fish for herring, unlike other folks, not to eat any herring or roe from the run. And if anyone comes across a dead blue heron, not to touch them. Some other specialists are also saying that there's a possibility that this could be a red tide. So we just don't know what's killing these, as you said, very impressive birds.
Let's go to the phone. George Brennan is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times newsroom. Hello, George.
Hey, Sean.
Hello to you. So you were looking at the H-2B visa cap. So this is like a worker's visa, and a lot of people and a lot of businesses in the region really rely on these workers, but there was a holdup this year, so we don't have quite the number of H-2B visa workers as usual. That's affecting the businesses on the island, right?
That's correct. I mean, this is pretty well documented by us, the Cape Cod Times, other outlets, even WCAI. But this story really hits home because it's a place here on the island, Nancy's, that a lot of people know. And there's a part of Nancy's called Donovan's Reef. And that has been a place where Donovan Clark served up his tasty drinks for years. And, you know, people are not seeing his familiar face there. It's a real loss. And as everybody knows by now, the number of H-2B visas given out were far fewer than in the past. And a big thing is returning workers weren't counted under the cap previously, but they are now. And that's why, you know, Donovan remains back in Jamaica instead of here on Martha's Vineyard serving up his drinks.
And there's no real solution coming, at least this year, that we've heard of, right? I mean, they're still trying in Congress to make a change.
Right. As much as our local delegation, including Congressman Keating, have tried to get a loosening of the cap, it has not happened. And so they're trying to fill in as best they can with teenagers and other people looking for supplemental income. But a lot of restaurants and inns here on the island are really suffering with a shortage of workers.
Times also had a story this week about, what is it, a dock near Menentia Beach, at Menentia Beach there, that some children were swimming feeling a weird tingle.
Yeah, so this was a end of the year, you know, beach junket by one of the schools in West Tisbury. So they went to Menentia, great spot, and the kids were wading in the water near the docks at a place called Crab Corner. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine they were hunting crabs in the water. And a couple of them said that they felt something, and turns out they were getting a little bit of an electrical shock. They're not sure exactly why, whether there was leakage from, but these docks have electricity, so when the yachts pull in, that they can hook up to them. So someone immediately shut off the power to the dock, and here we are almost a week later or more, and they're still trying to investigate exactly what happened there. We did find that it's a pretty common occurrence near docks. You really don't want to have your children or even yourself swimming near docks that have electricity because, you know, you can feel these little electric shocks or tingles from the water.
Okay. A little mystery there at Menentia Beach.
George, hey, can I say something on a personal note, Sean?
Of course you can, George.
Yeah, so Sean, you've been a strong and steady voice for the Cape and Islands, and you're going to be missed. I just want to say personally that I appreciate your willingness to give the journalist here on the Cape and Islands a voice. And congratulations, and let's stay in touch, my friend.
Well, thanks, George. I appreciate those kind words. It's really been an honor to be able to have a microphone and be able to bring on my colleagues from the print and digital media, you being one of them. Appreciate it, George. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times. Still a few stories to go through, mm-hmm. Jeff. There have been some power lines they've been talking about that had some birds on them. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, this is in Orleans, Sean. This has been going on for about 20 years, from what I understand. There are hundreds of cormorants that hang out on the power lines that are over Cedar Pond in Orleans. And they have been polluting the pond with their droppings. And so there's been a move over the course of the past several years to have these lines removed from being over the pond to bring the pond back to health. So finally, Eversource and the town have come to an agreement to move the lines to a neighborhood.
Great.
Adjacent
problem solved.
To the pound. Terrific. Except the neighbors are now upset that the cormorants will roost on the lines near their house.
Of course.
And the droppings will fall on their property, making them sick, causing sickness. So it's kind of one of those, you know, we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't.
What did they hear from the utility about this?
Well, you know, they finally got the utility to agree to move them. And the selectmen have said they're hearing the concerns of the neighbors. But this has been going on for, as I said, 20
right,
years.
Right.
And the selectmen told the neighbors, we've reserved our rights when we had this agreement with Eversource. So if it doesn't work, we'll bring it up again. So looks like it's going to move forward, and it's going to be something they're going to keep a close eye on down there.
Okay. And Yarmouth, the town of Yarmouth, is looking to use some land that they have, the transfer station land, for maybe, what are they calling it, like a renewable energy kind of hub that they could do there?
They're calling it a renewable energy hub, and this is going to be at the Yarmouth-Barnstable Regional Transfer Station, which already has a sewage treatment facility on it and a transfer station there. It's 14.5 acres. A lot of that property is going unused. So the town has said, hey, we have some room for development here. Why not lease some of this property? And one of the options they're looking at is an anaerobic digester, which breaks down solids and food waste and to produce energy and fertilizer. And this is something that has been done on Nantucket. There is not one on the Cape right now. There's one on Nantucket, and it's reduced the price of solid waste transfer and removal from the island by 86%, believe it or not, very,
wow.
Very a lot.
Yeah.
So the town of Yarmouth is looking at this as an option that would reduce the cost of transporting solid waste off Cape, which is now $75 per ton. And then it would have affect the residents as well, probably in the form of a lower sticker price. The other option they're looking at in combination with the digester is expanding the solar installation on the property, as we've seen in so many transfer stations and around the Cape with the solar farms. And the town last week received a $100,000 grant from the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center to explore both of these ideas. So, yeah, it looks like there's going to be some development of renewable energy on that site.
And do we think that other communities would be able to use that as well?
I would think they'd be looking at this very closely with some of those numbers with the digester. I mean, definitely.
I mean, the trash disposal mm-hmm. and garbage disposal here on the Cape has been an issue for a long time. They're trying to work it out. The tipping mm-hmm. fees just seem to be going up and up. And now, of course, we're in a position where the recyclables are costing money. You actually
they
have
are.
To pay to
they
get things recycled.
Exactly. Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And let's move over to Eastham, where residents there are a little concerned about a dollar store.
Yeah, they are. This is Dollar General, which is a national chain which wants to build in Eastham. And it's really created quite a bit of controversy in town. Of course, residents call Eastham the gateway to the national seashore, so they're not happy with the possibility of a chain store, especially a dollar chain store, being there. And there's been a Facebook group that's formed called Eastham is Worth More Than a Dollar. I checked on it last night. It has 300 likes right now. And what this Dollar General wants to do is clear 2.7 acres on Route 6 for a 9,100 square foot store, which just so happens to be 900 square foot under what would automatically trigger a Cape Cod Commission review.
Oh.
So the Board of Selectmen said, it, unfortunately, it meets, for them, it meets zoning requirements. There may not be much we can do, but there is going to be a public hearing on July 19th, and the board is going to ask the Cape Cod Commission to look at this as a project of regional impact and possibly do a discretionary review of it. And it's interesting, some of the reasons why this is being opposed, obviously, is the impact of small businesses and might affect tourism because people don't come to Eastham for big box stores. But one of the other reasons it's being used is something that, you know, I looked at and said, I never would have thought of that, but, you know, it's probably right on target. People will go and buy $1 plastic items, whether they be beach toys or whatnot. And they'll decide, hey, you know, why not? You're not going to take them home, leave them on the beach, and it will cause an additional litter problem.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, that's probably reasonable to think that.
So the selectmen have passed this along to the Cape Cod Commission, and what's the commission do?
They'll look at all the impacts. They'll look at traffic studies. They will look at conservation reports. They go through an entire process. Then they'll issue a report. So,
and this is a regulatory board that's charged with keeping track of development on the Cape and making sure that developments that do come here actually kind of fit the character.
Smart development fits the character, right?
Smart development. Right, they actually have areas set aside where they know, hey, this is an area we want to develop. Mm-hmm. This is an area we want to have the right utilities for certain types of development.
Exactly, growth incentive zones they call it, and there certainly is one in Hyannis. You know, this Dollar General actually has a store on Route 28 in Yarmouth.
Oh, it does.
It does.
And
it does.
I understand it. The company is based in Tennessee.
Yes, yes,
yes. So, okay, well, we'll continue to follow that story. And, well, we've reached the end of our time together. I want to thank all my guests. Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you very much, Jeff.
You're welcome, Sean.
Yeah, I've enjoyed every time you've come in to talk about the local news. As was mentioned earlier, this is my final time hosting the local news roundup. So thanks to all the great journalists who have joined me over the years. And thanks to you for listening. It's been a real pleasure spending time with you each week talking about the local news. Steve Junker will be the host. He's going to jump into the host chair next week. He'll keep you up to date on what's happening right here in our backyard. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for listening.